it's really like doing paleontology as it might have been done 100 years ago anywhere else in the world.
The banks of the Yukon River proved to be a gold mine of ancient dinosaur tracks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, searching for a Russian plane that went down in the Arctic Ocean in 1937.
We know they lost an engine 300 kilometers this side of the North Pole en route on the Meridian to Fairbanks, so they were on track at that point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A trip down the Yukon River this summer yielded big results for one University of Alaska paleontologist.
We found a ton of dinosaurs, literally.
Pat Druckenmiller is the curator of earth science at the Museum of the North. He and colleagues floated nearly 500 miles of the Yukon River, where they collected 1 ton of fossilized dinosaur tracks. It was all shipped by barge from Caltag to Fairbanks, where, as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it now awaits further investigation.
They're down this aisle right here.
Pat Druckenmiller leads the way past shelves of specimens in the basement of the Museum of the North. There are whale skulls, giant bones, and at the end of one dimly lit row, huge chunks of sand and mudstone.
So this is some of what we collected. And there's one for starters.
Those are huge.
He balances a giant tan-colored rock on his knee.
Yeah, totally.
So this is three toes of a medium-sized meat-eating dinosaur, possibly a small tyrannosaur, and you can even sometimes, right here, you can see the impression of the actual claw.
It looks exactly as one might expect a three-toed dinosaur footprint to look. This is one of thousands of preserved dinosaur tracks Druckenmiller and colleagues discovered this summer.
This and all the other material we found was just a total, complete surprise because no one expected anything like this was out there.
The team discovered the tracks along the Yukon River between the village of Ruby all the way to Caltag. Druckenmiller says part of the surprise is that no one in any of the villages they passed along the way knew what was hidden in the riverbanks.
I find it hard to believe that somebody didn't see these before, and maybe they didn't call them dinosaurs, but it looked, somebody must have found some very, you know, convincing footprints that made them wonder.
Research into the area's geology led some of Druckenmiller's colleagues to believe they might find something.
So they're Cretaceous age rocks from the age of the dinosaurs, about 90 to 100 million years old. And the cool thing is they had a lot of plant fossils, leaves from broadleaf trees and different types of conifers. In other places where we found tracks, this is a great combination of things to expect to find tracks. So sure enough, we said, let's go give it a try.
And the effort paid off. Other evidence of dinosaurs has been discovered along the Colville River on the North Slope and at Denali National Park. But Druckenmiller says these Yukon River fossils are 25 to 30 million years older.
And that's interesting because we know that climatically that was a warmer period in Earth history. Alaska was still farther north than it is today, so that these dinosaurs that we find on the Yukon River were living above, at or above the Arctic Circle when they were alive. And so that's really cool. And because they're older than the other tracks in the state, we get a sense of how dinosaurs changed through geologic time.
The discovery includes both meat-eating and plant-eating dinosaurs. Druckenmiller
really nice
pulls
one.
Out another specimen.
Oh, wow.
You can see that one really nicely. These are footprints of ankylosaurs, which are plant-eating dinosaurs that were armored dinosaurs. They were covered in these little bony plates all over their back and shoulders and head. They have a very distinctive kind of footprint. The hind foot, like this one here, has four toes, and the tracks are generally wider than long. And then the front foot has five toes, and they're about as long as they are broad.
He can identify some of the footprints based on bones collected from elsewhere in the state.
In some cases, we really don't know what the track maker was. And in fact, we have a couple of very strange footprints that we're still investigating and we think might be really exciting when we figure out what they are.
But he wouldn't elaborate. He says a new find like this is extremely rare in the 21st century.
It's really like doing paleontology as it might have been done 100 years ago anywhere else in the world, where you would go out and you'd be the first person to step and walk onto land and really look at it as a paleontologist and say, wow, you know, what kind of fossils are preserved in this? So it's exciting to be able to still do that in a place like Alaska.
The team has many years worth of work ahead before they can fully tell the story of the dinosaurs that lived along the Yukon River. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Alaska State Personnel Board has voted to include the same-sex partners of state employees in the definition of immediate family for purposes of leave. The board today changed rules that would allow state employees to take leave due to a serious health condition of a same-sex partner and also include same-sex partners in the definition of immediate family for that purpose. To be eligible, rules state that the same-sex partners must provide proof they and their partners meet five criteria, including such things as a mortgage or rental agreement. Same-sex marriage is barred under Alaska's constitution, but the Alaska Supreme Court has found it is unconstitutional to offer valuable benefits to the spouses of public employees, but not to same-sex domestic partners. The rules go into effect October 19th. Police have released the name of a young man who was found beaten and unconscious in an abandoned building in downtown Anchorage on Monday night. The victim has been identified as 18-year-old James Clinton of Anchorage. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Besides releasing his name, police have also released a photo of James Clinton, the young man who was severely beaten and left for dead in an abandoned building in downtown Anchorage earlier this week. Anita Schell is a spokesperson for the Anchorage Police Department. She says investigators are calling on the public to help them figure out what happened to Clinton.
We're really trying to piece together any information that we can come up with that led to his assault and who assaulted him and why. So we're asking folks to come forward. If they fear retaliation and want to remain anonymous, they can always do that through our Crime Stoppers line, and that's 561-STOP, or they could submit a tip online, also anonymously, at anchoragecrimestoppers.com.
Police say Clinton may have ties to the Matsu Valley. He went by several nicknames, and he frequented the downtown area. Around 8:30 Monday night, someone slid an anonymous note under the door of the University of Alaska Police Department, tipping them off that Clinton was being held in a vacant building in downtown Anchorage. Campus police handed the case off to the APD. Officers went to the building where they found Clinton severely beaten. Clinton remains unconscious and in critical condition at a local hospital. The building where Clinton was found belongs to Covenant House, a nonprofit that helps homeless teens. It was scheduled for demolition Thursday. Police say Clinton's family has been notified and they were able to confirm his identity. No arrests have been made. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a targeted approach to attracting tourists.
The stayover passengers contributed five times as much, with only one-third the numbers, as the cruise passengers.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
An Alaska Airlines jet with 64 people on board simulated what would happen if a plane crashed on approach to Juneau International Airport. The event took place on Saturday. Everyone on the plane survived, and many ate lunch with the emergency responders who came to rescue them. The fake crash was part of a live drill involving airport officials, first responders, and nearly 75 volunteer victims. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
The walking wounded are everywhere inside the Civil Air Patrol hangar at Juneau International Airport. Injuries range from bruised foreheads to bloody compound fractures of an arm or a leg to completely severed limbs. Fortunately, it's only makeup, also known as moulage. At about 8:30 a.m., Deputy Airport Manager Mark Cheatham calls for the victims to get ready.
Everybody, that's moulage. I need you out here. We're going to start loading up vans. We're going to put you at the accident scene.
The vans roll up to the Mendenhall Wetlands, just off the airport dike trail near the float pond. The trail doubles as the airport's emergency vehicle access road. In a real-life event, first responders would use the narrow strip of gravel to access the scene. A shipping container sits in the middle of the wetlands, simulating the airplane fuselage. The volunteers scatter around it, lying on the ground like victims of the crash. Over at the airport terminal, it doesn't take long for victims' families to show up looking for information about their loved ones. They're met by Red Cross volunteers who assign them roles to play as part of the drill.
You're a victim's family member from another country, and you have limited resources and you need help.
A family assistance center is established at the Extended Stay Hotel across the street from the airport. Ernie Muller is a Red Cross disaster response specialist.
They came in and we registered them. We had people from the Salvation Army to provide spiritual counseling. We had somebody from the Juneau Alliance for Mental Health to provide mental health services if they needed them. If they were hungry, we had food, we had teddy bears for the kids. Just whatever their needs are, we'll try to make it work.
Mueller says the Red Cross has agreements with airlines and the National Transportation Safety Board to provide emergency assistance in the event of a plane crash anywhere in the country. He says it typically takes the group's volunteers a couple hours to mobilize to a real disaster. This is his second time participating in a live drill at the airport, and Mueller says it went much smoother than the previous run.
There was a lot more information flow. We knew what was going on. We had a passenger manifest. We had people who were designated as family and friends. It worked out really well.
As the drill winds down, the emergency crews, airport officials, and volunteers gather back at the Civil Air Patrol hangar. Evaluators who have been watching every aspect of the scenario mingle with participants and discuss how to improve the response. Fire Chief Rich Etheridge is an evaluator for Capital City Fire and Rescue paramedics and firefighters. While he sees a lot to like during the drill, Etheridge says there are always areas for improvement.
You actually talk about these things in training, but to put it hands-on, you find out some of the communication links that we need to practice. One of them was one of the medical officers reporting to the triage officer, and they could have been reporting to the incident commander, and so just trying to straighten out some of that chain of command stuff.
The Federal Aviation Administration requires airports the size of Juneau's to do a live emergency drill every 3 years. This is the first one for Deputy Airport Manager Cheatham, who says one area he'd like to improve is relaying information to the press.
I'd like to be better at being a public relations person, especially with the media. In the future, we're going to have some training for this, so that's one area that I can improve myself on.
Cheatham says a full debrief of the drill won't be done for about a week. In addition to a triannual live drill, the airport does annual tabletop exercises to practice emergency response. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
In the summer of 1937, a Russian plane flying from Moscow to Fairbanks crashed in the Arctic. A headline that day in the Anchorage Daily Times blared, "Soviet flyers stranded in Arctic. Distress call heard in Anchorage." The aircraft and the six Russians on board have never been found. Efforts through the years to locate the plane have taken Alaskan pilot Ron Sheardown and Russian filmmakers and relatives of the crew to the Canadian Arctic and Alaska. Sheardown has been flying in the Arctic for 60 years. He says they have reason to believe three Inupiaq hunters at Oluktuk Point, northwest of Prudhoe Bay, may have seen the plane go down on August 13, 1937, in between Spy and Thesis Island.
And that would be correspond fairly close to the time that that airplane should have been hitting the Alaska coast en route from Moscow to Fairbanks. So we consider that probably the number one area to do bottom search in the ocean.
What's the backstory here? Why was the plane en route from Moscow to Fairbanks, and who was on it?
During 1937, two aircraft had flown nonstop from Moscow to North America. One landed in Vancouver, Washington. That was the Chkalov airplane. The second airplane arrived in California, somewhere east of Los Angeles. I forget the name of the town. And they were very historic flights. The third airplane that year that was to come from Moscow to North America was a four-engine aircraft with six people on board. That was commanded by Levinevsky. Sigmund Levinevsky was the pilot of that aircraft. We know they lost an engine, their number four engine, farthest right engine, 300 kilometers this side of the North Pole, en route on the meridian to Fairbanks. So they were on track at that point. And they were on track when they went over the North Pole because there was a Russian ice station there at the time that was talking to them.
Was this a cargo flight, or was it a flight just to make the trip, historic flight?
It was basically a flight to make the trip with a very large fuel tank and some items on board. There was like my understanding is there was like a fur coat for Mrs. Roosevelt and other trinkets and things, gifts for people.
Why is it believed that there were hunters or residents of that area that may have seen it? What evidence do you have that people witnessed this?
Oh, there's been plenty of interviews with both the Signal Corps and people in Barrow. The following day after this happened, the trader at Beachy Point, Jack Smith, went out by boat and found oil on the water, which all would be prime indication of what took place. The three natives that observed it had field glasses. They were able to they were hunting, and they were able to scan the horizon and see it go in the water. So it's pretty positive there's something there, but the water is very murky in that area. You cannot see very much into it. We were there last week, and you have very little visual. So it's a question of using geophysics to try to locate the aircraft. We're looking at forward sonar and gradiometer for next year to carry out a search.
As people hear this story, are you hoping that someone in Barrow or someone in Koktovik or that mm-hmm. area may come forward and say, you know, my uncle or my grandfather mm-hmm. was that person?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're hoping that sort of information will come forward. The most important bit of information we picked up this trip was that while we were in New Ixit, talking to the vice mayor and the cultural director, they talked about a whaleboat going out between Spy and Thesis Island 3 or 4 years ago and hit something and tore the bottom of the boat very badly. And we're waiting for those people to come back from whaling to see if we can find out more information, and especially any indication of what damage there was. It's a very sandy, gravelly area, and I don't expect any bedrock in the bottom at that point because it's just right out where the barrier islands are. So we're very, very interested in that information that just came out of a casual discussion in New Ixit.
Why are you so interested in this?
Well, I've flown all my life, and or at least since I was 16 years old, 60 years this year, and I've been involved in a number of searches. In fact, we were involved in one coming back from Barrow the other day where some hunters had hit the top of a mountain, and we were the first helicopter in on that emergency on our way from Barrow to Kotzebue. And we have always volunteered our time on searches. We feel that family, if someone is hurt or killed, family want to have a closing and they want to know what happened.
Ron Sheardown is an Alaskan pilot working with Russian filmmakers and relatives of a crew that crashed in Arctic waters in 1937 off the Beaufort Sea coast.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. Enroll Alaska, helping educate and enroll Alaskans in health insurance under the federal mandate created by the Affordable Care Act. Learn more at enrollingalaska.com. And by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
The oldest operating hotel in Alaska will get a makeover on TV. The Travel Channel's reality show Hotel Impossible will be in the capital city next week to film an episode on the Alaskan Hotel. According to the show's website, each episode features a hotel that is having problems or is not living up to its potential. The Alaskan Hotel recently celebrated its centennial anniversary. It opened September of 1913. The hotel was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1978. This is not Hotel Impossible's first time in the 49th state. The show filmed an episode at Yakutat's Glacier Bear Lodge in September 2012, which aired this past January. Pete Eads is general manager of the fishing lodge.
They come in and they beat you up pretty hard and then give you some ideas of what to do.
Eads says Hotel Impossible updated Glacier Bear's website, bought the lodge space at travel expos on the East Coast, offered ideas on how to save on shipping costs, and renovated a room. Glacier Bear Lodge spent $100,000 to renovate an additional 10 rooms. Eads says up to 85% of the lodge's business is from returning clients each year. The occupancy rate of the lodge, he says, has only increased 1.5% since Hotel Impossible.
I know for a fact we've got maybe two or three reservations of people who saw the show and wanted to come to Alaska, but you know, they're talking about how it's going to just make the lodge go off the hook, and it did not do that.
Hotel Impossible is revisiting the Glacier Bear Lodge this weekend before traveling to the capital city. The television crew arrives in Juneau on Monday and will be there for a week. Alaska's visitors spent $3.7 billion here during 2011 and 12, according to a state report. Although the financial benefits of tourism are undeniable, there can be a downside. Commercialization of scenic areas and overcrowding are two drawbacks. But one man wants to change how communities are affected by tourism. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the concept of geotourism focuses on enhancing the character of a unique place.
First, let's make it clear. Geotourism and ecotourism are two different things. Jonathan Turtelo coined the word geotourism, and he is the originator of the concept of destination stewardship.
It is all focused on what your place is all about, because you're emphasizing differentiation. Market differentiation is key to this, because you cannot be undersold if what you have is unique.
Turtelo says ecotourism is a 1980s concept that uses tourism to protect a natural environment. Geotourism takes the concept further. It makes the destination itself the product, and it relies on a cooperative effort among many people and entities. Turtelo established National Geographic Center for Sustainable Destinations and ran it for almost a decade. He says mass tourism ultimately destroys the distinctive place that initially attracted visitors. He says geotourism is counter to mass tourism because it doesn't focus on numbers, but on the type of tourist a destination wants to attract.
but rather look at how much are they spending, who are they benefiting, who's getting the money, who's getting the benefit of their presence.
Turtelo believes visitors are likely to seek out places that maintain their character and can demonstrate that character to the visitor through stories and demonstrations, even by serving unique local foods.
And a lot of these things you see are expressed through small and medium businesses and nonprofit groups. And that's both good for the community because it enriches the local life, and it's good for the traveler. It adds texture to the travel experience. Local people should benefit. And how they benefit is part of the interesting challenge of doing this right. Whether it's a broom maker in North Carolina, here's an Inuit soapstone carver in Baffin Island.
He had little data on Alaska, but in Belize, Turtelo compared the number of visitors who arrived on cruise ships with the number of dollars they spent there. Turtelo calls cruise ship passengers, quote, less adventurous tourists, and said 800,000 of them spent about $31 million compared with 236,000 tourists who traveled to Belize in other ways and stayed overnight at least once, adding $150 million to Belize's economy.
To put it another way, the stayover passengers contributed five times as much with only one-third the numbers as the cruise passengers. This is a colossal difference in benefit per passenger.
Turtelo has lots of data on American travelers. He says about 154 million of them have traveled during the past 3 years. But will geotourism work in Alaska? Sarah Leonard, president of the Alaska Tourism Industry Association, says yes.
And I do think some communities are already doing it, maybe just not calling it geotourism. I think for a small to medium-sized community, having those that are involved in tourism decide what kind of tourism and what kind of image they want to present from their community is all about tourism planning and reaching out to the markets of tourists that they want to attract to their community.
Leonard says large and small businesses can learn about marketing programs through associations like ATIA. A strong geotourism program for any community begins with local leaders, Turtelo says. Part of that is marketing. He says you have to get people to think of Alaska as more than Denali, bears, and the Inside Passage. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Casey Kelly and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer in Palmer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.